So today we will start with the sixth chapter onward. So till now we have been discussing how the Bhagavad Gita is answering Arjuna's question of what is the right thing to do. And it is expanding his scope of his frame of reference. So first it talks about you are not the body, you are the soul. And therefore, what your actions result in immediately is not as important as what they result in ultimately. Then Krishna talks about how detachment works when work doesn't seem to work. Then in the third chapter, Krishna talks about how it is through duty that we maintain social order and harmony, as well as we progress in spiritual order. And then in the fourth chapter, Krishna talks about the knowledge that enables us to act in a way that disentangles us. The frame of reference, how we can expand with spiritual knowledge further, that was discussed. In the fifth chapter, we discussed about how that there is, when we act with spiritual knowledge, then there is the concept of there is material diversity but spiritual equality. Because we see the difference at the level of the body, but we see also see the commonality at the level of the soul. So in today's session, we'll start with the sixth chapter onward, and I'll be sharing the screen now where I'll talk about the, we'll have the PowerPoint, which talks about the sixth chapter overview. It is the same PowerPoint which we had last time. So where I further extended it. So I will share the same PowerPoint on the WhatsApp group also, in case you would like to refer to it there and you're not able to refer here. And so let's look at the sixth chapter overview. The sixth chapter of the Bhagavad Gita talks about the process of yoga. Primarily yoga for connecting internally with our spiritual side. And the fifth chapter ended by talking, pointing to the ultimate reality. And the sixth chapter gives one process for progressing toward that ultimate reality. So here there are the chapter overview. So managing the first text, this is 47 texts in the sixth chapter. So texts 1 to 9 say that the theme is managing the mind is the key to rise from the preliminary to the advanced stage. Arurukṣa and Arudha, these two Sanskrit words are used over there. It's like a person who wants to first time get on a horse and the saddle. He's barely struggle and then they can't even stand on the saddle, slipping, falling, but then they rise again. So that is the Arurukṣa stage. Then Arudha is the person is comfortably sitting in the saddle and the horse is going according to their will. So like that, you know, if we consider the mind to be like the horse on which we are sitting. So initially, this is like a wild horse and we go wherever the horse is going. That is the uncontrolled mind, which in this section Krishna says can be our greatest enemy. Just as a wild horse can take a person into enemy territory, into dangerous territory, to death. So, whereas a horse which is controlled and disciplined can enable the person to go to their destination much faster than what they would go on foot. So a controlled mind is a great friend and an uncontrolled mind is a great enemy. So Krishna says that in the inner journey, how well we are situated, how on the horse of the mind, that is critical. And that how do we do that? That is the essence of the process of yoga. Now, if you remember the context of Arjuna's question, is Arjuna is concerned, should I fight or should I not fight? So should I engage in action or should I renounce action and go to the forest? So in that context, what Krishna is answering here is that whether you are inside a forest whether you are in a kingdom or in a forest. The important thing is, where is your mind? Is it in your control or is it out of your control? And without having the mind under control, going to the forest and being alone is not only of not much use, it is often a recipe for disaster. To some extent, it is our society that saves us from insanity. It is the community, the people around us, they keep us sane. At each moment, our mind can give us hundreds of options. And if we are to not get carried away by any of those options, and especially the mind can come up with the craziest of options. And if we are not to get carried away, it is largely because we know people around us will question us, they will disapprove us, they will criticize us. So, of course, we don't want our actions to be determined only by society, only by social approval or disapproval. But the point is that in general, if we are living around decent people, then that keeps us decent. So if we are going to be alone and we are alone with our mind, then the curbs that society places on the mind's tendency toward insanity are removed, because there's no society around us. And then we will ruin ourselves, or rather our mind will ruin us. So Krishna says the first stage is that you need to manage your mind. You need to discipline your mind. Now, in this chapter, Krishna is taking a path to a conclusion which goes through another path. That means, Krishna has earlier told Arjuna that it is best that you do your duty with detachment. But then Arjuna may feel that maybe it is better that instead of fighting this war, I go to the forest and I meditate. And by the solitary meditation, I gain spiritual elevation, spiritual liberation. So in this chapter, Krishna will say how that path of going to a forest will also have to ultimately culminate in a spiritual focus. And that spiritual focus is available to him right now in the kingdom also, in the battlefield also. So it is better that he seek spiritual focus where he is, rather than go away thinking that that will help him to focus spiritually. So Krishna does two things in this. By going through another path, this is the path of Ashtanga Yoga. I'll talk about that a little bit more. But by going through this path, what Krishna shows firstly is that this path is not the ultimate. It is penultimate. And ultimately, he has to come to a devotional focus. And also, this path is extremely difficult. That Arjuna himself will admit in due course. So sometimes, rather than telling someone that something, don't do something, it is give them a view of what doing that will entail. And they themselves will come to a decision that, hey, maybe this is not the path I want to go along. So that is what Krishna does over here. So the word yoga, so now let's look at 10 to 32. So as I said, focusing the mind is the key. So Krishna talks about how focusing the mind can lead to progressively higher and higher levels of spiritual realization. So practice to perfection. That's what is the journey. And he talks about this journey in three different levels. And each of these, it's like a spiral. When you have a spiral, it moves round. It's moving ahead. It's coming closer. Again, it moves round. And again, it comes closer to center. And again, it moves around and comes further and closer till it hits the bullseye. So like that, Krishna is going on a spiral towards the bullseye. So in the first five texts, Krishna talks about here how when we practice the process of yoga. What is this process of yoga? That one goes to a jungle, sits in solitary meditation, and gives up all sensual indulgence and first focuses on an external object like the tip of the nose or the space between the eyebrows. And then gradually, by that focus, draws one's vision and concentration inward. And then, when one does that, one starts perceiving a light within oneself. And one realizes this light is not just within me, this light is everywhere. And when we understand that this light is everywhere, that is the time when we grow in our spiritual journey. That is the time when we learn to move onwards. In recognizing that there is a reality beyond matter. That is the reality of spirit. The reality of the supreme spiritual, of a spiritual reality. Now the Bhagavad Gita describes this ultimate spiritual reality is actually three level. This elaboration will come in a later verse in the 9th chapter. But I'll introduce this concept over here. That there is the all-pervading light, there is the universal witness, and there is the all-attractive supreme person. Technically, they are called as Brahman, Paramatma, and Bhagavan. The idea is that whenever we perceive anything, the closer we are to it, the better we perceive it. So, if we consider some delicious dessert, say maybe in India, there's gulab jamun. Now, this dessert, now any delicious item, its key thing is taste. But attractive food should not just taste good, it should also smell good. It should also look good. So suppose we are sitting in a room and then we hear, we get sense the fragrance of some dessert. Then, oh, we get attracted. Now, we are experiencing the desert, but we are experiencing one aspect of that desert, that is its fragrance, and through our nose. Oh, then we say, where is this? And then we maybe walk toward the kitchen, and there we see on plates that desert is being served. And then we see it, this looks so attractive. So first we are seeing with the, we are smelled with the eyes, smelled with the nose, then we are seeing with the eyes. And then we go there and we sit there, we pick up the plate and then we eat it. So when we eat it, that's the time when there is a complete experience. So similarly for us, the absolute truth can also be experienced differently at different distances. So the first perception of the absolute truth is as a all-pervading light. And that is called as Brahman. That is like perceiving the fragrance of the gulab jam. Then the next is when we see the fragrance, when we sense the fragrance, and then we see the shape, the attractive spherical juicy shape, soft shape, soft succulent shape of the gulab jam. So that's the experience of the Paramatma. That yes, there is not just one all-pervading consciousness which is like a celestial divine light, but actually there is also a person. There is a conscious observer who is observing me, who is overseeing what is happening. So it's not just a light which underlies all of existence, but there is a conscious source of that light. There is a conscious being who oversees existence. So the impersonal light underlies existence, the conscious being that oversees existence. That is the Paramatma understanding. That God is also a conscious being who witnesses. And then as we go closer and realize the spiritual truth deeper, then it's like experiencing gulab jamun by tasting. That is the time when we understand its full experience. So the full experience is that God is not just a being who observes. He's also a being who reciprocates love, who is not just the giver of benedictions, but who is also the source of all attraction, who embodies everything attractive in this world. So that is the complete experience of the ultimate reality. So in terms of the mind, the whole journey here is, how can one get one's mind unattached, keep it unentangled while functioning in the world? So the idea is, Krishna says, first, withdraw your mind from the world, but that's not enough. Then you have to direct your mind towards spiritual reality. And in that spiritual reality, the first thing we perceive is, beyond the changing world of matter, there is some unchanging substrate of spirituality. That is the first perception of the spiritual. But beyond that, there is another perception. That is, say, if we are being tossed about in an ocean, here is wave, there is wave, and we find some kind of stone which we hold on to. So that is one level of shelter. But then we find that the stone is not actually a stone. We thought it's a hard object, but it's a life raft, or it's a lifeline thrown to us, and there's a person behind it. And then our vision shifts from the lifeline to the person. So similarly, what happens is, on the spiritual path, first, we need something unchanging to focus on, and that is the spiritual light. Then we look at what more is there in that unchanging, and there we see there is a conscious person. And then once we are pulled out, we see that that person is not only just saving us, maybe like a lifeguard saving us out of duty, but that person is very attractive, and that person loves and cares for us. Then it's an entirely different dimension. That if you're not just trying to survive amid the ocean, but we want to link with, in love, the person who is our savior. So we just from being a survivor in the ocean, we want to link with the savior. So similarly, on the spiritual journey, we move forward with deeper and deeper realization. So the idea is, fixing the mind on spiritual reality becomes easier when spiritual reality becomes clearer. And that clarity comes as one gains more and more spiritual knowledge and realization. And then after this, Krishna, in the next section, so now Arjuna has spoken all this, Arjuna has heard all this. And Arjuna says, actually, Krishna, you're telling me to detach my mind from matter, and then fix it on spirit. See the equality of everything spiritual, beyond the duality of material things. He said, but the mind is very restless. I can't fix it. Then, so like I said, don't tell a person, don't go on this path. Let them themselves see how tough the path is. And they will say, okay, I don't want to go by this path. So that's what happens to Arjuna. Arjuna says, this is too tough. I can't do this. He says, I might be able to control a raging wind, but I can't control my mind. And then Krishna says at that time that, yeah, it's possible. But he says, you need the right process. So he says that, have the right process, then have patience and have perseverance. So it's like if we are sick, so if we are coughing very severely because of sickness, then it's not just a matter of willpower. I will not cough. That's not going to work. We need a proper process. Willpower is required to follow the process. In this case, it may be that we have to avoid any cold food items. We have to wear warm clothes. We have to take a particular kind of maybe hot food only. Whatever it is. So the process. So we need willpower, but it's not raw willpower. It is refined willpower directed for following the process. And while following that process, we can't expect that I just take one hot drink and my cough goes away. I need patience. I need perseverance. So Krishna doesn't tell here specifically what process to follow. But Arjuna himself says that his process is very difficult. And then, this is Arjuna's first question. And the second question that Arjuna asks is okay, you're saying that I should persevere, but what if this life is not enough? What will happen then? Say, suppose we are going on a very long ride and we fear that our fuel will run out along the way and it's wilderness. Then what? I will go on that ride, but if my fuel runs out, what will I do? So similarly, if we fall short, if we resolve to practice spiritually, but then our restless mind makes us go off track, go back to the material way of living, then what will happen? And this is a beautiful section, and there Krishna assures that the spiritual inclination, the spiritual attraction that we have developed is never lost. Even if we get temporarily deviated, even if we are deviated for the rest of our life, in our next life, we will carry that spiritual attraction. And that spiritual attraction will bring about, again, a spiritual reorientation. We'll be spiritually reinstated. We'll come back on the spiritual path and ultimately we'll attain this spiritual perfection. So the idea here is that spiritual growth is a treasure that continues with us from one life to another. We may have a big bank balance, we may have a big bungalow, we may have a great car, but none of those will go with us after death. But our spiritual attraction that we develop toward transcendence, that will always stay with us. So Krishna assures that even if we don't complete the spiritual journey, we don't lose on the spiritual journey. We carry our credits and continue from that point. So if somebody has developed up to 40% spiritual, covered 40% distance, that means they have 40% spiritual attraction. In the next life, they start from 41%. And then in the last part, so this was 38 to 40, 45, and last two texts, 46 and 47, Krishna says that that better than working in the world is working to connect with spiritual reality. And better than just connecting with spiritual reality is lovingly devoting oneself to spiritual reality. And that higher spiritual reality is Krishna. So this whole process of yoga, this chapter culminates in Krishna telling Arjuna that the best way to fix the mind is to fix it on Krishna. So there is a two-step process over here. First, Krishna talks about how we are attached to the world, and what is attached? This is the mind which is attached. So we need to detach ourselves. And after we have detached ourselves from the world, then we seek out what is spiritual reality and become attached to that spiritual reality. So it's like, say, if somebody is carrying a big, heavy stone in their hand and they're being weighed down by it, the boulder practically. And then somebody wants to give them a treasure. Maybe a suitcase filled with jewels. They could either put whatever the boulder they're carrying, they lower the boulder, put it down, and then they go and pick up the suitcase. Or just move their hands to pick up the suitcase, and as they, for picking up the suitcase, they spread out their hands, then can grab the suitcase and the stone falls away. So Krishna in the next chapter onward will describe how, will take forth from the conclusion of this chapter, that rather than first detaching oneself from matter, renouncing the world, and then finding the spiritual and trying to attach oneself to the spiritual, Krishna says just straight try to attach yourself to the spiritual. And you will, by that, as a side product, as a byproduct, become detached from the material. So this sixth chapter is quite long. And that's why I went a little over time in explaining this. And I'll focus on one theme in the sixth chapter. That is, spiritual growth is conscious, continuous cultivation. This is 6:25 and 26 in the Bhagavad Gita, where Krishna says, yato yato nishchalati manaschanchala vastiram tatastatonyam yaitat atmanya eva vashamnayet. That wherever and whenever the mind wanders, bring it back under the control of the self. So the mind may stray away, let it not stay away. Bring it back. And in this case, each of these articles which are what the sentences that are described in the description that are there in the slide body. This is a hyperlink, and if you click on this, there is a Gita Daily article which elaborated this theme. Then the essence of commitment is recommitment. So what Krishna means in this context in terms of managing the mind means that we can't expect that we decide from now, I'm not going to let my mind go to this or that or that. I'm going to focus our mind, my mind, and it's going to be focused. No, we have to repeatedly focus. It'll go off focus, we bring it back on focus. It goes off focus, we bring it on focus. So commitment is not something which we do it once and it is there forever for us. This commitment essentially means we keep recommitting ourselves again and again. When a plane is flying through the sky, at that time, it's not that the plane just goes in a straight line. No. The plane, it said 90% of the time, it is off course. But the pilot, it's off course because of its own momentum, because of the atmospheric conditions, because of the wind. But the pilot keeps reorienting. And that repeated reorientation is what gets the plane to the destination. So similarly for us on our spiritual journey, on our journey for inner growth, it's recommitment which will demonstrate our commitment. Not just a one-time decision, but a repeated reorientation. Without getting discouraged that why am I forgetting this? Why am I getting distracted? Why am I getting deviated? We expect that and we prepare accordingly. We reorient ourselves. So that is, repeated reorientation is what is required for managing the mind. So are there any questions based on the sixth chapter overview at this stage? Okay. So let's move on to the seventh chapter. So seventh chapter is a very interesting development in the flow of the Bhagavad Gita. In the seventh chapter, what is happening? If we consider the first six chapters were centered on how our essential identity is non-material. It is spiritual. So therefore, knowing that we are non-material, we can detach ourselves from the material. But from the seventh chapter onwards, the focus shifts, not that we detach ourselves from the material because we are non-material, but because the non-material reality is so much more attractive than the material. And what is that non-material reality? I talked about a three-level experience of a gulab jamun. So from the seventh chapter onwards, the close-up experience, the experience of the ultimate reality as an all-attractive person will be described. So this chapter has 25 texts, and those 25 verses, is broadly two sections can be had. That one is, the previous chapter ended with, the topmost yogis fix their mind on Krishna. Now why Krishna? Why should they fix their mind on Krishna? Why not anything else? So then here, first part describes the position of Krishna. So it gives us knowledge of Krishna as the object worth being supremely attached to. So Krishna is the ultimate reality. And knowledge has no meaning or really no value unless it is applied. It's suppose somebody is sitting at a lunch table and they give a long talk about how delicious and nutritious the food is. Well, that talk is not of much use unless people eat the food. The talk is important to the extent it inspires people to eat. So similarly, spiritual knowledge alone is not enough. So the second part is, how do we apply that spiritual knowledge? That is by connecting with Krishna in love. That is by surrendering to Him and knowing that that is the path to ultimate liberation. So the first part is knowledge. The second part is the application of that knowledge in terms of developing a personal relationship with the ultimate reality. Merely acquiring spiritual knowledge without applying it is like, it won't lead to any spiritual advancement. It is like reading books on weight loss and expecting that will cause us to lose weight. Now, reading books on weight loss is fine, but we have to actually apply them. Then only we'll lose weight. Similarly, reading books about spirituality can't make us spiritual, just as reading books on weight loss alone can't make us lose weight. So after reading, what we do is important. So let's look at these two sections of the seventh chapter. Here, the first section is, as I said, within the first section, now there are certain subsections. In many chapters in the Bhagavad Gita, in the 7th chapter and 9th chapter, in the 10th, 11th, 14th chapters, many chapters Krishna begins by an attention-grabbing verse or series of verses. Just like if somebody gives a talk and they start by telling, now today I will give you a secret by which you can earn $1 million within a month. Now, whether they can give a secret or not, whether there is a secret by which anybody can earn $1 million in a month, that's a question. But if somebody starts like that, then even if it's a false promise, it catches attention. But suppose some medical researcher has found a cure for an hitherto incurable disease. And they proclaim, now today I will tell you the cure for a disease that has not, whose cure has eluded millions of researchers for who have spent millions of dollars on it. But we now have the cure. Now everybody will be full of attention. So Krishna, he draws attention to the message by first speaking about the glory of the knowledge. He says, this knowledge, if you understand this, then in essence, you understand everything that is necessary for living a meaningful life. He says, this knowledge is such that only one among thousands, even millions, ever master this knowledge. And those who master this knowledge, they attain life's perfection. Then what is that knowledge? That earlier, in the first six chapters, the vision of the Bhagavad Gita was more of dissection. Dissect reality into matter and spirit. And Arjuna, you do not belong to matter, you belong to spirit. Therefore, the dissection leads to detachment. But now, the Gita goes beyond dissection to integration. That yes, there is matter and there is spirit. But both matter and spirit come from this ultimate reality. Come from the all-attractive Supreme Person. Come from Krishna. So in this way, from dissection to integration, the Gita's journey is. So it describes Krishna as the source of everything material and spiritual. And then Krishna is not just the source, but he's also the sustainer of everything. It's like we might say that our family, our particular dynasty started maybe 10 generations ago with XYZ. Now, okay, that person is the source of our dynasty, but that person is long gone and dead now. That person is no longer there. So Krishna is not that kind of source who existed long ago and is now dead, and no longer there. So Krishna is the source and the sustainer, the pervader of everything. So here, the Gita talks about how God permeates all of material existence. So God is, everything in this world is permeated with God's presence. Basically, there are two aspects of God with his relationship with respect to the world. One is called as his transcendence and the other is his immanence. Transcendence means God exists beyond matter. Beyond the material world, God exists in another level of reality. That is transcendence. Means transcendence to go beyond matter. But immanence means God exists within matter also. God pervades all of reality. So here Krishna talks about how he is not, although he's transcendental, he's not inaccessible because he's also immanent. He's present in the world. And thus we can connect with him. Then how does one connect with him? How, if he is pervading everywhere, all of existence, then is everybody connected with him? And Krishna, the next part of this verse describes that. That actually, so this is a very important principle which will be reiterated in the 10th chapter also, elaborately. But when we say God pervades everything, that means that the attractiveness of everything comes from God. So if there's someone who's very good looking, now their good looks come from God. It is God who has given them those good looks. Now, of course, they may take care of their looks and they may apply makeup and everything. But beyond that, some people are just born beautiful. They did not craft their beauty while they were in the mother's womb. They're just beautiful. Similarly, some people are just brilliant. They're intelligent, so sharp. Now, they didn't make themselves sharp. They did not do anything to have a high IQ score while they were in the mother's womb. So their brilliance comes from God. It is God's gift to them. And their brilliance reflects God's supreme brilliance. So the idea here is that whatever attracts us in this world is actually a spark of God. But most of us don't know that. And that's why we get attracted to those sparks and we go away from the home. It's like suppose we are in a desert. And while we are in the desert, we see some drops of water sprinkled here and there. Oh, these drops will lead me to the ocean. And we start following the trail of drops. And then we will get to the ocean. But suppose the drops are sprinkled everywhere. So we are here, the ocean is here. The ocean is here. And there are drops sprinkled here also, drops sprinkled here also. So now we need to know which drops will take us to the ocean and which drops will take us away from the ocean. So all the drops of water have come from the ocean. But all the drops of water do not take us to the ocean. Similarly, everything attractive comes from God. But everything attractive doesn't take us to God. So whenever we become attracted to something, we surrender to something. We surrender. For example, when two people get romantically attracted to each other, they say, we fall in love. So fall is the idea that we give ourselves completely. It's like surrender. So when we are attracted to something, we just fall. We just get captivated by it. But are we getting captivated by the drops which are taking us toward the ultimate reality or taking us away? Or just taking us laterally here and there? We have to see that. So why should we surrender? Because he is the all-attractive source of all attractive things. And he is the ocean. So instead of chasing the drops, we look for the ocean. That's the mood of surrendering to Krishna. And Krishna talks about those who surrender to him. Those who don't surrender. There are some people who get attracted to the drops which take them away from Krishna. So there are different kinds of people would be atheistic, materialistic, nihilistic, and they do not surrender. Then Krishna talks about those who surrender. Now, they also progress gradually. That gradual progression in their conception of God. That will be talked about. I'll talk in a later slide. But those who surrender and gradually they attain complete love for God. That's the perfection of life. But then, there are those who may surrender to something other than God. That is, they may be attracted not to the Supreme Person, they may be attracted to the light. You remember the light I talked about, like they are attracted to the fragrance of the Gulab Jamun, but they are not so much attracted to the shape or the taste of the Gulab Jamun. And also, in the tradition of, in the Dharmic tradition of India, it is described that there is not just one God. Now, we have this whole polarity of monotheism and polytheism. But what the Bhagavad Gita describes is that this is simply a polarity based on a particular worldview, a particular theology. There is one God or there are many gods. And if you see, the Greco-Roman tradition had many gods, and that's why it was considered polytheistic. But the Abrahamic religion, Judaism, Christianity, Islam, have one God. They are proud of being monotheistic. And they condemn polytheism as a very primitive conception of God. And often they think that the Dharmic traditions from India are also polytheistic. But actually what the Bhagavad Gita reveals is neither the monotheism of the Abrahamic religions nor the polytheism of the Greco-Roman tradition. It is what you can call as polymorphic monotheism. It's one ultimate reality, but polymorphic. And one ultimate reality manifests at multiple levels. So there is one supreme God, God with a capital G. And there are many gods who are God with a small g. So they are the assistants of the gods, assistants of the supreme God. So in the Abrahamic tradition, there is one true God and there are many false gods. And the idea is that because there is only one true God and all false gods are upstarts, so they have to be destroyed. And this idea often leads to religious intolerance. In fact, if you look right from the Old Testament to the Quran, wherever any religious ruler conquers a kingdom, the first thing they do is destroy the idols of the false gods. Because their idea is, there's one true God and all others are false. So to proclaim the glory of the one true God, the false gods have to be destroyed. But the Vedic understanding is, the Gita's understanding is that there is one true God and there are many other assistant gods. And ideally speaking, the assistant gods pave the way for the person to reach to the supreme God. And in that sense, they aid one on the spiritual journey. Now, of course, it may happen that sometimes some people start thinking of the assistant gods to be the supreme God. And then that can become an obstacle. But it's meant to be a progressive path. So Krishna says that those who surrender either to the gods or to the light, it depends on their conception. Do they see the light and the gods as their aids, their pointers to some higher reality? Or do they see these only as the ultimate reality? That will determine their destination. And if they can see that everything attractive is a pointer to the all attractive, then the soul in the world can get liberated by knowledge of that ultimate reality. That's the focus of the Bhagavad Gita's 7th chapter, that when we gain knowledge of the supreme, the all-attractive supreme person, then that knowledge inspires us to surrender to that absolute reality. And by surrendering to that reality, we can attain liberation. In fact, liberation has two aspects to it. Just like we can talk about freedom. There is freedom from and freedom for. Freedom from means if somebody wants to become free from some kind of addiction. Say maybe it's drug addiction or alcohol addiction. So it's important to become free from those things. But more important than becoming free from something is to become free for something. Okay, if you become free from drugs, what are you going to do? In one of the most successful social experiments in helping people become free from drug addiction is in Portugal. Now, Portugal decriminalized all drug indulgence, and many people are saying, so therefore if you dig, and then it's seen that their drug addiction rates decreased by almost 50% from the 2000 in the last 19 years, and so there is a big push to decriminalize drugs. But it is not that decriminalizing drugs detached people from drugs. It was what they did after that. They used all the money that they were not that was being used to try to criminalize and persecute drug users and drug peddlers, to rehabilitating drug users. So they said that if somebody is a drug user, and people maybe, employers might actually be apprehensive to give them jobs. Said, they would tell the employers, you employ this person, and the government will pay half the salary. So basically they help people create a life worth living. And once more and more people started having a life worth living, then they became detached from drugs. So the point here is, this is, I'm giving an example, not so much of that we should decriminalize drugs, as that what makes a person addicted is not so much that the substance is so attractive, but rather the rest of life doesn't seem meaningful or attractive. That's why they relapse into it. So whenever somebody has to give up something, if you focus too much on, I have to give this up, then it's a very negative focus. Instead, we focus on what can we take up. And once we have something worthwhile to take up, then giving up becomes much easier. So the Bhagavad Gita reveals this vision from the 7th chapter onwards, that instead of seeking freedom from matter, that freedom from matter is detachment from matter, detachment from material results, detachment from material things, material pleasures. Don't so much worry about freedom from, focus on freedom for. Understand what awaits us when we become detached from matter. When our consciousness becomes free and available to experience spiritual reality. Understand how attractive the supreme spiritual reality is. And then we can become captivated by that reality. And then we can joyfully march toward liberation. That is the 7th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. Let's take one theme from it. So the same point, this is talking 7:19, see God as the ultimate object of the mind's search for pleasure. Often people think that, oh, if I try to become devoted to God, I have to give up so much pleasure, so many pleasures. There's an atheistic joke about Christianity. Now in the Bible it says, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was God. So that talks about how, you know, through articulated speech, our sound is the way to experience and access divinity. And that's what is the basis of our mantra chanting also. But that's what the atheists, what they say, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was no. That is, they think of religion as simply saying, no, don't, you can't enjoy this, you can't do that. Now once we have this negative, restrictive, depriving conception of religion, then we just can't function with much positive energy. So the Gita reveals God is an all-attractive supreme person who is the ultimate object of the mind's search for pleasure. And when we understand this, we can become devoted to Him. So devotion commences when God becomes our guide. That rather than, we might go to God and pray, please fulfill this desire, please fulfill that desire. That's good. That's religious piety. At least we're connected with Him. But that is more of a transactional kind of interaction. You know, I do this worship and you do this to me. But what devotion is meant to be, not transactional, but transformational. That it's meant to transform us, raise our consciousness, transform our definition of pleasure. Instead of looking for pleasure in finite material objects, we look for that pleasure in the infinite spiritual reality. So when we do, so initially we might go to God thinking, I know this is an object of pleasure. Oh God, please help me to get it. But that is fine, but that is not really devotion. That is just preliminary religious piety. But devotion commences when God becomes our guide. Guide in the sense of what? Okay, what is the source of pleasure? What is the way to a meaningful, fulfilling life? When we become open to learn that from God, then that's when our devotional journey commences. Arjuna, that's what happens. Initially, he was saying that fighting this war is not the way to pleasure, it's the way to misery. I won't fight it. But then his journey towards enlightenment begins when he stops imposing his own definitions of pleasure and pain and asks Krishna, what is the right thing to do? So he accepts Krishna as his guide, and that's how the Bhagavad Gita's journey begins. The similar devotion begins, it commences when God becomes our guide, and it culminates when God becomes our goal. That means we understand that God is not simply teaching us of how to go where by which you can find pleasure. God himself is the source of all pleasure. He is the source of everything attractive. And thus, we need to devote ourselves to him. So that devotional surrender to God is the essential message of the 7th chapter. So any questions about this till now? Okay.
Hi.
Yes, ma'am. Yes,
Barbara. Oh, my gosh, this is so wonderful. Thank you. So I'm actually doing 12 step, and I'm just at the point of surrender. So I'm hearing that word a lot. And, you know, I've been coming to temple a long time, and these words like surrender, yoga, transcendental knowledge. Could you just maybe say two or three things? I know what I have to do. Like, I know to chant, but can you just maybe say some practical examples if you don't live in the temple and you want to, how do we surrender, and how do we, well, they're two separate, like, how do we actually grow to love God and make him our goal? And I guess, how do we surrender? What does that mean? And what are some practical things that we can do on a daily basis to surrender? Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Varadhan. So how do we surrender to God practically? What does it mean in our day-to-day context? At one level, surrender means to give ourselves completely to God. At another level, surrender means to do what we can with what we have now. Surrender means to do what we can with what we have now. So, if we have a tiny nascent attraction towards God, then we focus on that and we develop that. So broadly, this is a big subject. Just recently, a couple of weeks ago, I gave a 4-part seminar on the 6 limbs of surrender. But surrender as the 6 limbs are, you can understand this from a medical metaphor perspective. First is, it says, accept what is favorable, avoid that which is unfavorable. It's like a doctor will give us prescription and proscriptions. So similarly, based on our God-given intelligence, in our situation, look at what is favorable and try to do it as much as possible. So whenever you can, go to the temple. Whenever you can, you associate with those who are devoted to Krishna. And avoid that which is unfavorable. If there are certain influences which are pulling us down, try to keep a distance from them as much as possible. So surrender here as this dynamic, action-oriented understanding that we are constantly choosing. Is this favorable? Is this unfavorable? That's surrender. So if you consider the medical metaphor, in a medical metaphor, there are probably 3 things. One is that the patient does their part in terms of the prescriptions and the prescriptions. Second is the patient has faith that the doctor can cure. And third is, the patient has faith in the cure. So similarly, for us, faith in the cure means the patient has faith in this context in one's own curability. That this cure can cure me. That the doctor can cure, the doctor is wise enough, expert enough to cure me. And this treatment can also cure me. This treatment, I am curable. So first of all, there is the action-oriented, we accept the favorable, avoid the unfavorable. And beyond that, there's the conceptions that we have to address. That, it's, although we are on our own spiritual journey, which in many ways is unique, but still it is not that we are the first one on the spiritual journey. There have been many before us. Bhavo jnana tapasa puta mat bhava magata. So millennia people have tread on the search for the ultimate reality. And many have succeeded. And we too can succeed. So this understanding is vital for us that, yes, God is expert enough. No matter we may be very far away from God, but God can extend His hand. His hand can become long enough to reach out to us wherever we are and lead us by the finger towards Him. So just do what you can, wherever you are. Try to do the things that take you closer to Krishna and try to avoid the things that take you away from Krishna. And by doing this, know that from wherever you are, Krishna is expert enough to draw you towards Him. And we might say that, oh, I have so many conditionings, I have so many weaknesses, I have so many impurities. Actually, God's love for us is not just based on who we are. It is based on who He is. That means even if we feel I am so ungodly, maybe I'm not worthy of God's love. Well, God's love for us is not based on our worthiness or unworthiness. It is based on His godly nature. So He is there for us and He can uplift us from wherever we are. So just do what you can. And that means that right now, wherever you have some attraction towards Krishna, just focus on that, do that more and more. Say, for example, if you find maybe hearing classes as attractive, but you find my chanting difficult, then at least make sure that you hear some talks regularly, and then use that attraction to your class, to the spiritual wisdom, as your anchor for stabilizing your chanting. Say, all if the mind wanders you in chanting, rather than letting it wandering while chanting Krishna's names, maybe you take some attractive point, philosophical points about Krishna's beauty and glory that you have heard in the class. Keep them on a notepad in front of you. And then, if the mind wanders, let it wander toward that point. So there is a point of concentration and there is a circle of concentration. That if we can't focus on that point, we don't have to go all over the universe. We can go around in a circle. If the mind wanders, let it wander to that philosophical point. That way, what will happen is we will stay close to Krishna. Even if we are not focused on Krishna, we will stay connected with Krishna. So, this in Sanskrit is called as Uddipan. Uddipan is spiritual attraction or spiritual stimulus. So, we find our own spiritual stimulus and use that as our anchor for going closer and closer to Krishna. Does it answer your question?
Yes, I'm so humbled. I feel so blessed that it's knowledge. Hare Krishna. Thank you.
Thank you, Hare Krishna. So, let's move on. Is there any other question right now? Okay. So, I'll move on to the last part of the... this session, where we'll talk about the 8th chapter now. Now, in the 8th chapter, Krishna, it's a very interesting chapter about, firstly, let's look at how it is developing from the 7th chapter. In the 7th chapter, Krishna talked about bhakti, about understanding Him as Bhagwan and surrendering to Him with bhakti. Now, Krishna is going to integrate the knowledge of chapter 6 and 7 in chapter 8. Chapter 6, if you remember, talked about how in the process of yoga, one first becomes detached from matter and then becomes attached to the supreme spiritual reality. In 7th chapter, by knowing the spiritual reality, this doesn't exist far away in the forest or far away in some other level of reality, but exists everywhere. We start connecting with that spiritual reality right away. That's the 7th chapter. So in the 8th chapter, Krishna talks about how He draws a contrast between the path of yoga, which is Ashtanga Yoga. Ashtanga Yoga means going out in the forest, meditating, and Bhakti Yoga, which is the path of love. But before that, there is a slight technicality, which I just mentioned, but I will not go into. See, every field of knowledge has its own jargon. Jargon is, the word jargon sometimes have as a negative connotation, but the point is that whenever people become specialized in any field, they start using terms for referring to things which only they can understand. Say, if two software engineers are going to talk about something, Then if somebody who has no knowledge of software engineering, they come, what are you talking about? There's so many terms over there. So like that, in the dharmic tradition, or you could say the dharmic dictionary, there are many spiritual terms. And Krishna mentions those spiritual terms towards the end of the 7th chapter, primarily to talk about how Krishna is the ultimate reality. So he uses words like Adi Bhuta, Adi Daiva, Adi Yajna. And he uses other terms also, which are in the broad Dharmic dictionary, like Karma, Brahma, Adhyatma. And then Arjuna, so Krishna talks about these terms, and then Arjuna asks question, what do these terms mean? Now Krishna answers those questions, the first 6 questions, he basically answers in 2 verses. So the verses 1 and 2 in the 8th chapter are Arjuna asking certain questions. And Krishna answers the six terms in one line in the next 2 verses. And then he focuses on the 7th question almost throughout the whole chapter. So the 7th question is that Krishna tells that if you have this conception of the ultimate reality, and if you maintain this conception at the time of death, then you will attain the ultimate reality. So the question comes up over there that, okay, Krishna asks Arjuna, or Arjuna asks Krishna, okay, how can one maintain one's composure at the time of the greatest distress, at the time of death? Then Krishna answers that question. Now, for most people, death is just a time of great trauma. It's a time that we don't even think about. And we, in today's world, frequently talk about death without ever thinking about death. That means there's talk about death everywhere in the world. There are newspaper headlines which talk about casualties. There are movies in which there is so much horrific violence and death. But we don't really seriously think about our mortality because it's scary. However, what the Bhagavad, once we understand that we are souls on a multi-life journey of spiritual evolution, then we see death not as a full stop where our existence ends, but we see death as a comma. It is just a transition. Like when we are phrasing a thought, a full stop, a period means the thought has ended. But a comma means, yes, the thought is going on, but maybe in a slightly different direction. So death is a transition, not a termination. And where does one go after death? That depends on what one is thinking about at death. So this is important. It is not a mechanical act. Okay, so Krishna says that what we remember at the time of death, we will attain. What this means is not that it's not so much like an intellectual remembrance. Like somebody remembers, what is the capital of Ukraine? Or what is the capital of New Zealand? What is the capital of Somalia? It's not factual knowledge. The remembrance refers to the thing that is closest and deepest in our heart. We remember that. It's like what we take shelter of. Generally, whenever we are in distress, at that time, our mind gravitates toward that thing in which we have experienced the greatest comfort. It's like if our house was caught in a tornado, then we would go toward that part of the house, maybe some underground cellar, which is the sturdiest and which is the most likely to withstand the onslaught of the tornado. Similarly, in our life journey, we all experience storms and we all experience shelters among the storms. Say, for example, you might feel very bored or frustrated and you might just go and watch a movie. That movie gives us some shelter. Or you might just chat with some friend and our temperature goes down, emotional temperature goes down. So that's also, these are all shelters. Now, at the time of death, which is the time of the greatest distress, like the ultimate tornado hitting us, our mind will naturally go toward that, which is that thing where we have experienced the greatest shelter. And that thing, Krishna says, should be God, should be Him. So, to remember Krishna at the time of death, we need to remember Him throughout our life. And not just remember Him again in an intellectual, factual sense. Remember Him as our ultimate shelter. So, amidst life's storms, if we can take shelter of Krishna and experience shelter in Krishna, then in life's final storm, that is death, we will naturally seek the shelter of Krishna. And here what it means is that if we, when we take shelter of something, that means we value it. We recognize that this is the thing which is the foremost strength, the foremost value. So if we become attached to Krishna, then we attain Krishna. That's the whole significance of remembrance of Krishna at death. So that's 5 to 8. Now, how may one cultivate such remembrance of Krishna? Krishna talks about different strategies for that. And one is that even in the practice of yoga, yoga is sitting in postures, regulating one's breath, and gradually drawing one's consciousness inward. Even in that, ultimately, like Krishna has told in the 6th chapter, one has to come to the level of bhakti, one has to remember Him. So, remembrance by yoga practice permeated with bhakti. That is one way of cultivating the remembrance of the divine. And Krishna says, if we do this, then we will attain the divine. Then, that is 9 to 13. And 14, 15, he recommends something else. He says that it is better that if we focus on me directly, not through the yoga practice, but through your love for me. That if you do this, this is much, much easier. And after this is one of the few verses in the Bhagavad Gita where Krishna says that the spiritual path can be easy. Normally he talks about how this is tough, it requires perseverance, patience, you may have to persevere beyond one life to another lifetime, and the mind will wander, you have to bring it back. So it talks about how this process is tough. But here he says, if the process of spiritual growth is powered by love for the Supreme Spiritual Reality, then this process becomes easy, it becomes joyful. Sulabhaha is joyfully attained. Then after that, Krishna takes another line of thought. See, the idea here is that whenever we want to tell someone to do something, if we just impose rules, it triggers resentment. Now, why should I do this? Say, do this, don't do this. Why? What will happen if I don't do this? That's what it triggers. So rather than giving people rules, what we need to help, give people the vision to see rules as routes. This is the route and this is where it will take you. Give them that vision. So if I'm on a particular path and somebody tells me, don't go left, don't go right, don't go back, just go straight. I say, why? What's there on the left? But if then I see, on the left there's a big cliff, and from there there's a big fall into a valley. On the right there's a huge mountain. On the back side, there is wilderness. And then straight ahead is the path to civilization, path to comfort, path to a city. This is where I want to go. So rather than just giving people rules, we need to give others a multidimensional explanation of the reason for going on a particular route. And once when we give a multidimensional explanation, some explanation clicks. If you just give one explanation, sometimes people just don't find that explanation relatable or digestible. So we give multidimensional explanations. Okay, this is one reason, this is one reason, this is one reason. Oh yeah, this makes sense to me. Oh good, then follow it. So like that, for cultivating remembrance of Krishna, the Bhagavad Gita is giving here multi-dimensional explanations. So one explanation which is gives here in the 16 to 22 verses is, earlier Krishna has talked about matter and spirit, and that we don't belong to the world of, we are not material, we are spiritual. Now, that dissection of reality into matter and spirit was talked about. Now Krishna takes this further and says that it's not just matter and spirit, there is a material world and there is a spiritual world. The material world is the place where everything is temporary. And this is where Krishna says, this world is dukkhalaya. It's a well-known verse, 8:15 and 16. 8:15 says that this world is a place of misery. Now, many Western thinkers, when they were introduced to the Vedic texts, they said, this is so world-denying. This is so pessimistic. Actually, it's not pessimistic. It is, we could say, initial pessimism for eventual optimism. It's like if a patient is sick and the patient doesn't realize how sick they are and the patient doesn't want to take treatment, then the doctor may have to give the prognosis in the gravest possible terms. You know, you're here right now, then your kidney might collapse, or your lungs might fail, or you might develop dementia. And the doctor tells, it might seem, what is the doctor doing? Why is the doctor telling such something so scary? But the idea is, there has to be that initial pessimism that things cannot go on the way they are. Then the doctor talks about the cure and then says that this is a time-tested cure. Many people have been cured. There are not many complications. Just take the treatment. Then it's a message of optimism. So sometimes we need to see how terrible will be the results of the path we are going on for us to change course and go on another path. So what the Bhagavad Gita does over here, when it says this world is dukkhalaya, it's a place of misery, it gives us this unvarnished picture of our destination if we live in materialistic consciousness. We'll all grow old, we'll all get diseased, we'll all lose our capacity to enjoy the things that we consider enjoyable. And we will sink into misery and ultimately we will die. So it's a very stark picture. But the idea is, then what is the solution? The solution is, we don't have to live in material consciousness. We can rise towards spiritual consciousness. And for rising towards spiritual consciousness, what is required? We need to follow a process that raises us from material to spiritual consciousness. And that process is the process of Bhakti Yoga. So Krishna talks about this contrast here in broad terms of the nature of the world itself. So he said, this world is a place of distress and ultimately destruction. Whereas there is another world. The other world is the world of eternity. It is the world of eternal life, eternal love, eternal joy. Now this is one of the biggest differences between pre-modern and modern times. In the pre-modern times, whether it is the Indian civilization or the Middle East African civilization, the European civilization, the Native American civilization, the Russian civilization, almost everywhere people had this understanding that this world is like a journey and there is another world which is a better world, and that is what is to be attained. But through the progress of science and technology, humanity's hope started increasing that why do we need to go to some other world which is supposed to be paradise? Through technology, we will create paradise in this world itself. And thus, the fantasy of a technological paradise relegated to the background any thought of spiritual paradise. And now people think of any spiritual paradise as a fantasy. But while this is a historically, we can outline how this has happened, but essentially, no matter how much we advance technologically, still we remain mortal beings. We have to grow old, we have to get diseased, and we have to die. And we still long to live forever. So where does our longing to live forever come from? Suppose we are sitting in a room which is made of, say, stone and concrete and normal construction material, and suddenly we see some gold fallen over there. Maybe it's a golden nugget, a golden ring or whatever. Then the first question we'll have is, hey, where did this gold come from? So it's, and nothing here in this room is golden. This must have come from somewhere. So is there some treasury with a lot of gold from where this has come over here? So like this, similarly, everything in the world here is temporary. But we long for eternal life. And like we discussed in the second chapter of the Gita, how we are spiritual beings, we are indestructible. So if everything here is destructible and we are indestructible, then where did we come from? We must have come from some indestructible level of reality. And that is the spiritual reality. That is the spiritual world. So this is a reasonable inference we can make pointing to spiritual reality. So Krishna also again stresses to Arjuna, you fix your mind on me by talking about how this world is destructible, whereas the spiritual world is indestructible. And again he says, the way to attain the spiritual world is by focusing on the Lord of the spiritual world, on Krishna. And then again, the last part of the 8th chapter goes into a little bit of technicalities, where it talks about how, with respect to the moment of death, traditionally, in the dharmic way of living, certain times of dying are considered auspicious. But Krishna says, don't get caught in such technicalities. If you have focused your mind on the ultimate reality, then the time, place of death is not as important as the consciousness of death. And thus, Krishna says, focus your mind on developing the right consciousness. So in Ashtang Yoga, the yogis, they regulate their breath, and by regulating their breath, it is said our number of breaths in a life are fixed. So if we can slow down our breathing, one school of thought is that we can live longer. So then they try to, in this way, by slowing down their breath, they try to plan to live, to die at an auspicious time. But Krishna says, you don't have to bother about all these intricacies of Ashtanga Yoga. If you just learn to love me, then you will attain me, no matter when or where you die. Because your consciousness, your heart will be attached to me. And that brings us to the last point, which we'll discuss in today's class, that our disposition at death determines our destination after death. So at death, we don't have to leave home. We can go home. As 8.7, the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, if you strive to remember me throughout your life, you will attain me at the end of your life. Tasmat sarveshu kaleshu mamanusmarayudhya cha mayarpitamano buddhir mame vaishasya samshaya. That if you remember me constantly throughout your life, then your mind and intellect is absorbed in me, you will surely come to me at death. So basically, when we talk about home, home is the place where our loved ones are, where those whom we care for, they are there. Now, if we practice bhakti, then Krishna becomes our supreme loved one. And then when we die, we understand that we are going to Krishna. Or if you're not pure enough to go to Krishna, then at least we'll go closer to Krishna. And in that way, we are not leaving home. Because, okay, yes, we will have to leave our physical home with where our loved ones are there. But we will go to our spiritual home where our supreme loved one is there. So if we can develop our love for Krishna by the practice of bhakti, then death is seen not as a brutal separation from our loved ones, but as a transition for an eternal reunion with our supreme loved one. So one of the great commentators in the Bhagavad Gita, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, he gives an example that normally, say if a girl is to get married, is to be married, then the tradition was that the girl was living in her parents' home, and she leaves her parents' home to go to her husband's home where her in-laws are living. And often because it's a new life, new people, so there is some apprehension. There can even be fear. But if there has been a long courtship before the marriage and the girl knows the groom, loves the groom, the girl knows the groom's family, loves the groom's family, then although at one level she is leaving her own parents, there is eagerness, there is anticipation, there is excitement, there is joy to go to her husband's family. So similarly, Vishwanath Chakravarti says that the practice of bhakti yoga in this life, in this world, is like our period of courtship with God. That we are in this world and God is not entirely accessible to us. Just like when people are courting, when they are married, they are always with each other. But when they are courting, then there are some times when they are together, sometimes they are not together. But when two people are courting, then they are, even when they are not together, they are constantly thinking of each other. When will we meet next time? But the excitement of newness is there. So similarly, he says, we can treat our practice of bhakti yoga in this world like a courtship with God. And whenever we get the opportunity, you know, we try to make the maximum of that opportunity. We try to spend as much time with Krishna by hearing about Him, reading about Him, worshipping Him, associating with those who are devoted to Him. And when we can't, we go on with our life, but we try to cultivate that longing to be more and more with Krishna. And if we do this, if by the end of our life, if our love for Krishna has become more than our love for this world, then Krishna will take us out of this world. There is no reason for us to be in this world if we don't love this world. If we love Krishna, then naturally we will go to Krishna. And that is life's supreme perfection. So I'll summarize what I spoke today. I spoke on this theme of how the Bhagavad Gita's, 6th, 7th and 8th chapters are taking the question of what should Arjuna do forward. So first, in the 5th chapter, Krishna has talked about how you should be detached with knowledge. Then Krishna talks about, okay, if you want to not only just be detached with knowledge, but actually be detached from the action in the world also, what is the qualification? First, you have to regulate your mind. And without managing the mind, just being isolated from society is the pathway to disaster. Then he talks about after detaching the mind from matter, you focus the mind on spirit and get an increasingly clearer perception of spiritual reality. The all-pervading, the light, then the conscious being who is witnessing, who is the source of that light, and then the all-loving person. And then the mind will find it very difficult to just detach itself from matter and focus on some unknown higher reality. So Krishna says, persevere. And even if you can't complete in one life, you can continue in the next life. And then he hints to what will be developed in the next 7 to 12 chapters. That is, that the point is not just to detach oneself from matter, but the point is to attach oneself to the supreme spiritual reality, Krishna. That is the topmost yogi. The 7th chapter talks about two main things. Why is Krishna worthy of being the supreme object of attachment for us? Because he is not just the supreme spiritual reality, the source of all of reality. The Bhagavad Gita dissects reality into matter and spirit and integrates reality, both material and spiritual reality, by saying that they are coming from one source. And that source is present even in the world as the immanent reality. So, talking about how Krishna is the attractive principle in all attractive things. And just as we have an ocean, there are water drops sprinkled all along in the desert. So everything attractive comes from Krishna, but we have to focus on those attractive things that take us toward Him. We want water, but we need to focus on those drops of water that lead us to the ocean, not away from the ocean. And so different, some people may surrender to Krishna, some people may surrender to anti-devotional attractive things, which take them away from Krishna. Or some people may surrender to transitional realities, which if they understood properly, can help them go toward Krishna. That is like the inner light, or the various gods. And ultimately, Krishna talks about how by knowing Him, and if we live that knowledge, that means we read about weight loss and then apply it, then we lose weight. Similarly, we learn about Him and then we seek to love Him. Then we will become liberated. And then the 8th chapter focuses on the theme of who is the of what will happen at the time of death. So we talk about at death to remember is not just like an intellectual factual remembrance. It is we will remember at death that thing which has given us the greatest shelter before death. That's why we need to practice bhakti amidst life's storms and experience our greatest shelter in Krishna. And Krishna is a multidimensional approach to encourage Arjuna to fix the mind on Him in bhakti. And he says that this is easier in the path of yoga. And then he says that actually this world is temporary and perishable. So better focus on the other world and focus on the Lord of the other world. And then he talks about how you don't have to worry about the technicalities. When you die, if your consciousness is fixed on me, you will surely attain me. And he concluded by discussing how the practice of bhakti yoga in this life we can see as a courtship period. Then death will not be something which takes us away from home, but it will take us home. Thank you very much. Is there any one question? Yes, Shilpi.
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
Sir, one question. Yeah, in chapter 6, for me, it is easier to understand the concept of Brahman and Paramatma realization.
Hmm.
But it's a little difficult to understand a one realization. So is it possible to understand it as a direct experience rather than an intellectual concept or a conclusion?
Can you specify a little bit why you find it difficult to understand Bhagavan as compared to Brahman and Paramatma?
My understanding, I understood that in one realization, we are actually talking about a personality, supreme personality of Godhead, which is just like us, but we have not seen it mm-hmm. with our eyes. So it is difficult to perceive realization. But Brahman and Paramatma realization is a little bit easier to understand because we can understand the concept of soul. And there is so much of research on near-death experiences and all of out-of-body experiences. So it's easier to understand that concept. And Brahman realization, because it is easier to see how everything around us, like mountains and water bodies, and, you know, there are big energies that we see around us, which are moving in a certain order. So...
Okay, I got your point. It's a good question. So, how can we gain a better appreciation for the personal aspect of the divine, of the ultimate reality? There are different modes of inferring things. And we have to look not only at what inferences we can draw, but also what blocks we might have in drawing certain inferences. So at one level, we could say that we see that there is personality all around us. We are persons. We have our personality. People around us have their personality. And personhood is an integral part of our identity. So if the ultimate reality is the source of everything, the ultimate reality should also have personhood. In fact, we will consider there are two distinct things. There's form and there's personhood. We often associate form and personhood together. But form is also very attractive. And if the absolute truth does not have form, then the absolute truth lacks that which is very attractive in the world. That means the source of the world will end up being lesser than the world. That's one way of looking at it. Now, another way of one normal objection to this is that the personal form, if it's a person with form, then it's limited. And the absolute truth is supposed to be unlimited. So, here we have to understand that there is this dichotomy of personal and impersonal. But God is neither personal nor impersonal. God is what you can say transpersonal. Transpersonal means it's a transcendental personality. So in the world, personality and form limit. But for God, there is no such limitation. What do I mean by no such limitation? That God is more a person than the persons of this world. That his form does not limit him. If we think that form causes limitation, then imagine if, say, you are sitting in a room now, and that room is limited. It has a particular form, and it is limited. Now, suppose we destroyed that form. Suppose we blew up a bomb over there, and that form was destroyed. Would the formless heap be limited or unlimited? It would still be limited. So, what causes limitation is not form per se. It is matter. When material things are there, whether they have form or no form, they are limited. When spiritual reality is there, spiritual reality has the potential to be unlimited, whether it has form or whether it doesn't have form. So God is not limited by his form. So if that is the stumbling block that we have, we can consider that God is not limited by his form because he is not limited to his form. He can be at one place, at the same time, he can be everywhere. Advaitam, achyutam, anadim, anantarupam. He's non-dual. But that doesn't mean he has no form. Anantarupam. He has unlimited forms. And then another point to look at is that if we consider that God or the ultimate reality is the embodiment of rasa, is the embodiment of all the things that lead to the formation of a loving relationship. So our heart longs for relationships. And in Krishna, there is a supreme opportunity for relationships. So we are at times when we have had many bad relationships, we may feel, I just don't want any relationship. So that's like a person who is very sick. Maybe they've got arthritis in many parts of their body. And every moment causes pain. I move my hand a little bit. Everything causes pain. So at that time, the person may simply desire, if I could just stop moving, I would be free from pain. Now it's very difficult to stop moving, first of all. And even if they stop moving, what will happen is, they may become free from pain temporarily, but soon they will desire to start moving again. Because the cause of their pain is not motion. The cause of their pain is disease. And stopping motion doesn't create a meaningful life for them. It just removes pain, but it doesn't bring meaning. And they want meaning ultimately in their life. Some meaning, some value, some joy. So similarly for us, we might have had some negative experiences with relationships. We might have had negative experiences by being attracted to forms, by people with particular personalities. And you might feel that no form, no personality, no relationship. I just want peace. That's like saying, I just don't want to move my body at all. Yeah, that will give us relief, but it's temporary. So for us, we need to know that although God is a person, he's not a person like us. It's a different ball game entirely. That's why I said transpersonal. That's why if we just focus on maybe hearing the pastimes of Krishna, reading about Krishna Leela, and seeing Krishna not as we see him, but trying to see Krishna as those who are devoted to him see him, from that perspective, then a whole new universe will open for us. So approaching Krishna as an object of love, as he is approached by his devotees, can help us see that Krishna's personality does not limit him. That there is a whole arena of reality beyond just the attainment of peace, beyond the agitation of the world, material world. That can help us arise towards spiritual, toward a spiritual appreciation of Krishna's personality. Does that answer your question?
Yes, Raju, thank you.
So thank you very much. And we will continue next Monday, and then we'll be discussing from the 10th chapter on 9th to 12th. We will try to take 4 chapters in the next session. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna. Thank you so much.